blocks from Andy's. I thought about phoning him, maybe asking him to meet me, and then decided against it. Certainly I could call him if I got desperate. He would gladly sneak out, bring me a change of clothes and money snitched from his mother's purse, and who knows, maybe a bunch of leftover crab meat canapes or those cocktail peanuts that the barbers always ate. But the word handout still scalded. As much as I liked Andy, it had been almost 2 years, and I couldn't forget the way that Mr. Barber had looked at me. Clearly something had gone wrong. Badly. Only I wasn't quite sure what, apart from knowing that I was responsible somehow, in the generalized miasma of shame and unworthiness and being a burden that never quite left me. Without meaning to, I'd been staring into space. I'd made accidental eye contact with a man on a bench across the way. Quickly, I looked away, but it was too late. He was standing up, walking over. "Cute mutt," he said, stooping to pat Popper. And then, when I didn't answer, "What's your name? Mind if I sit down?" He was a wiry guy, small but strong-looking, and he smelled. I got up, avoiding his eyes, but as I turned to leave, he shot his arm out and caught me by the wrist.
"What's the matter?"
he said, in an ugly voice.
"Don't you like me?"
I twisted free and ran, Popper running after me, out to the street, too fast. He wasn't used to city traffic. Cars were coming. I grabbed him up just in time and ran across Fifth Avenue, over to the Pierre. My pursuer, trapped on the other side by the changed light, was attracting some glances from pedestrians, but when I looked back again, safe in the circle of light pouring from the warm, well-lighted entrance of the hotel, well-dressed couples, doormen hailing cabs, I saw that he had faded back into the park. The streets were much louder than I remembered. Smellier, too. Standing on the corner by A la Vieille Russie, I found myself overpowered with the familiar old midtown stench. Carriage horses, bus exhaust, perfume, and urine. For so long I'd thought of Vegas as something temporary. My real life was New York. But was it? Not anymore, I thought, dismally, surveying the thinned-out trickle of pedestrians hurrying past Bergdorf's. Though I was aching and chilled with fever again, I walked for 10 blocks or so, still trying to work the hum and lightness out of my legs, the pervasive vibration of the bus. But at last the cold was too much for me, and I hailed a cab. It would have been an easy bus ride, half an hour maybe, straight shot down Fifth to the Village. Only after 3 solid days on the bus, I couldn't bear the thought of jolting around on another bus for even a minute more. I wasn't that comfortable at the notion of turning up at Hobie's house cold. Not comfortable about it at all, since we hadn't been in touch for a while. My fault, not his. At some point, I'd just stopped writing back. On one level, it was the natural course of things. On another, Boris's casual speculation, "Old Poofter," had put me off him, subtly, and his last 2 or 3 letters had gone unanswered. I felt bad. I felt awful. Even though it was a short ride, I must have nodded off in the back seat, because when the cabbie stopped and said, "This all right?" I came to with a jolt, and for a moment sat stunned, fighting to remember where I was. The shop, I noticed as the cabbie drove away, was closed up and dark, as if it had never been opened again in all my time away from New York. The windows were furred with grime, and looking inside, I saw that some of the furniture was draped with sheets. Nothing else had changed at all, except that all the old bric-a-brac, the marble cockatoos, the obelisks, was covered with an additional layer of dust. My heart sank. I stood on the street for a long minute or two before I worked up my nerve to ring the bell. It seemed that I stood for ages listening to the faraway echo, though it was probably no time at all. I'd almost talked myself into believing that no one was at home, and what would I do? Hike back to Times Square? Try to find a cheap hotel somewhere, or turn myself in to the runaway cops? When the door opened very suddenly, and I found myself looking not at Hobie, but a girl my own age. It was her, Pippa. Still tiny. I'd grown much taller than her, and thin, though much healthier looking than the last time I'd seen her. Fuller in the face, lots of freckles, different hair, too. It seemed to have grown back in with a different color and texture. Not red-blonde, but a darker, rust color, and a bit straggly, like her Aunt Margaret's. She was dressed like a boy, in sock feet and old corduroys, a too-big sweater, only with a crazy pink and orange striped scarf that a daffy grandmother would wear. Brow furrowed, polite but reticent. She looked at me blankly with the golden brown eyes. A stranger.
"Can I help you?"
she said. She's forgotten me, I thought, dismayed. How could I have expected her to remember? It had been a long time. I knew I looked different, too. It was like seeing somebody I'd thought was dead. And then, thumping down the stairs, coming up behind her, in paint-stained chinos and an out-at-elbows cardigan, was Hobie. "He's cut his hair," was my first thought. It was close to his head and much whiter than I remembered. His expression was slightly irritated. For a heart-sinking moment, I thought he didn't recognize me either, and then, "Dear God," he said, stepping back suddenly. "It's me," I said quickly. I was afraid he was going to shut the door in my face. "Theodore Decker, remember?" Quickly, Pippa looked up at him. Clearly, she recognized my name, even if she didn't recognize me, and the friendly surprise on their faces was such an astonishment that I began to cry.
"Theo!"
His hug was strong and parental, and so fierce that it made me cry even harder. Then his hand was on my shoulder, heavy, anchoring hand that was security and authority itself. He was leading me in, into the workshop. Dim gilt and rich wood smells I'd dreamed of, up the stairs into the long-lost parlor, with its velvets and urns and bronzes.
"It's wonderful to see you," he was saying, and, "You look knackered," and, "When did you get back?" and, "Are you hungry?" and, "My goodness, you've grown," and, "That hair, like Mowgli, the Jungle Boy," and,
worried now,
"Does it seem close in here to you? Should I open a window?"
And, when Popper stuck his head out of the bag,
and, "Ha! Who is this?"
Pippa, laughing, lifted him up and cuddled him in her arms. I felt lightheaded with fever, glowing red and radiant like the bars in an electric heater, and so unmoored that I didn't even feel embarrassed for crying. I was conscious of nothing but the relief of being there, and my aching and over-full heart. Back in the kitchen, there was mushroom soup, which I wasn't hungry for, but it was warm, and I was freezing to death. And as I ate, Pippa cross-legged on the floor, playing with Popchick, dangling the pom-pom from her granny scarf in his face. Popper, Pippa. How had I never noticed the kinship in their names? I told him, a little, in a garbled way, about my father's death and what had happened. Hobie, as he listened, arms folded, had an extremely worried look on his face, his mulish brow furrowing deeper as I talked.
"You need to call her," he said. "Your father's wife." "But she's not his wife. She's just his girlfriend. She doesn't care anything about me."
Firmly, he shook his head.
"Doesn't matter. You have to ring her up and tell her that you're all right. Yes, yes you do," he said, speaking over me as I tried to object. "No buts. Right now, this instant. Pips,"
there was an old-fashioned wall phone in the kitchen,
"come along and let's clear out of here for a minute."
Though Zandra was just about the last person in the world I wanted to talk to, especially after I'd ransacked her bedroom and stolen her tip money, I was so relieved to be there that I would have done anything he asked. Dialing the number, I tried to tell myself she probably wouldn't pick up. So many solicitors and bill collectors phoned us all the time that she seldom took calls from numbers she didn't recognize. Hence, I was surprised when she answered on the first ring.
"You left the door open,"
she said almost immediately, in an accusing voice.
"What?" You let the dog out. He's run off. I can't find him anywhere. He probably got hit by a car or something.
No.
I was gazing fixedly at the blackness of the brick courtyard. It was raining, drops pounding hard on the window panes. The first real rain I'd seen in almost 2 years.
He's with me.
Oh.
She sounded relieved. Then, more sharply,
where are you? With Boris somewhere?
No.
I spoke to him. Wired out of his mind, it sounded like. He wouldn't tell me where you were. I know he knows.
Though it was still early out there, her voice was gravelly like she'd been drinking or crying.
I ought to call the cops on you, Theo. I know it was you two who stole that money and stuff.
Yeah, just like you stole my mom's earrings.
What?
Those emerald ones. They belong to my grandmother.
I didn't steal them.
She was angry now.
How dare you? Larry gave those to me. He gave them to me after...
Yeah, after he stole them from my mother.
Excuse me, but your mom's dead.
Yes, but she wasn't when he stole them. That was like a year before she died.
She contacted the insurance company, I said, raising my voice over hers, and filed a police report. I didn't know if the police part was true, but it might as well have been.
I guess you never heard of a little something called marital property?
Right. And I guess you never heard of something called a family heirloom. You and my dad weren't even married. He had no right to give those to you.
Silence. I could hear the click of her cigarette lighter on the other end. A weary inhale.
Look, kid, can I say something? Not about the money. Honest. Or the blow. Although I can tell you for damn sure, I wasn't doing anything like that when I was your age. You think you're pretty smart and all. And I guess you are. But you're headed down a bad road. You and what's-his-name, too.
Yeah, yeah,
she said, raising her voice over mine.
I like him, too. But he's bad news, that kid.
You should know.
She laughed, bleakly.
Well, kid, guess what? I've been around the track a few times. I do know. He's going to end up in jail by the time he's 18, that one. And dollars to donuts, you'll be right there with him. I mean, I can't blame you,
she said, raising her voice again.
I loved your dad, but he sure wasn't worth much. And from what he told me, your mother wasn't worth much either.
Okay, that's it. Fuck you.
I was so mad, I was trembling.
I'm hanging up now.
No, wait, wait. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said that about your mother. That's not why I wanted to talk to you. Please, will you wait a second?
I'm waiting.
First off, assuming you care, I'm having your dad cremated. That all right with you?
Do what you want.
You never did have much use for him, did you?
Is that it?
One more thing. I don't care where you are, quite frankly. But I need an address where I can get in touch with you.
Why is that?
Don't be a wise ass. At some point, somebody's gonna call from your school or something.
I wouldn't count on it.
And I'm going to need, I don't know, some kind of explanation of where you are. Unless you want the cops to put you on the side of a milk carton or something.
I think that's fairly unlikely.
Fairly unlikely,
she repeated in a cruel, drawling imitation of my voice.
Well, maybe, but give it to me all the same, and we'll call it even. I mean,
she said when I didn't answer.
Let me make it plain. It makes no difference to me where you are. I just don't want to be left holding the bag out here in case there's some problem and I need to get in touch with you.
There's a lawyer in New York. His name's Bracegirdle, George Bracegirdle.
Do you have a number?
Look it up, I said. Pippa had come into the room to get the dog a bowl of water, and awkwardly, so I wouldn't have to look at her, I turned to face the wall.
Bracegirdle?
Zandra was saying.
Is that the way it sounds? What the hell kind of name is that?
Look, I'm sure you'll be able to find him. There was a silence. Then Zandra said,
You know what?
What?
That was your father that died. Your own father. You act like it was... I don't know, I'd say the dog, but not even the dog. because I know you'd care if it was the dog got hit by a car. At least I think you would.
Let's say I cared about him exactly as much as he did about me.
Well, let me tell you something. You and your dad are a whole lot more alike than you might think.
You're his kid, all right, through and through.
Well, you're full of shit,
I said after a brief, contemptuous pause, a retort that seemed to me to sum up the situation pretty nicely. But long after I'd hung up the phone, when I sat sneezing and shivering in a hot bath, and in the bright fog after, swallowing the aspirins Hobie gave me, following him down the hall to the musty spare room.
You look packed in. Extra blankets in the trunk. No, no more talking. I'll leave you to it now.
Her parting shot rang again and again in my mind as I turned my face into the heavy, foreign-smelling pillow. It wasn't true. No more than what she'd said about my mother was true. Even her raspy, dry voice coming through the line, the memory of it, made me feel dirty. Fuck her, I thought sleepily. Forget about it. She was a million miles away. But though I was dead tired, more than dead tired, and the rickety brass bed was the softest bed I'd ever slept in, her words were an ugly thread running all night long through my dreams. Part 3. We are so accustomed to disguise ourselves to others that in the end, we become disguised to ourselves. François de La Rochefoucauld. Chapter 7. The Shop Behind the Shop. 1. When I woke to the clatter of garbage trucks, it was as if I'd parachuted into a different universe. My throat hurt. Lying very still under the eiderdown, I breathed the dark air of dried-out potpourri and burnt fireplace wood and, very faint, the evergreen tang of turpentine, resin, and varnish. For some time I lay there. Popper, who'd been curled by my feet, was nowhere in evidence. I'd slept in my clothes, which were filthy. At last, propelled by a sneezing fit, I sat up, elbowed my sweater over my shirt, and grappled under the bed to make sure the pillowcase was still there, then trudged on cold floors to the bathroom. My hair had dried in knots too tangled to yank the comb through, and even after I doused it in water and started over, one chunk was so matted I finally gave up and sawed it out, laboriously, with a pair of rusted nail scissors from the drawer. Christ, I thought, turning from the mirror to sneeze. I hadn't been around a mirror in a while, and I barely recognized myself. Bruised jaw, spattering of chin acne, face blotched and swollen from my cold, eyes swollen too, lidded and sleepy, giving me a sort of dumb, shifty, homeschooled look. I looked like some cult-raised kid, just rescued by local law enforcement, brought blinking from some basement stocked with firearms and powdered milk. It was late. 9. Stepping out of my room, I could hear the morning classical program on WNYC. A dream familiarity in the announcer's voice. Kirkel numbers. A drugged calm. The same warm public radio purr I'd woken up to so many mornings back at Sutton Place. In the kitchen, I found Hobie at the table with a book. But he wasn't reading. He was staring across the room. When he saw me, he started.
Well, there you are,
he said as he rose to messily sweep aside a pile of mail and bills so I could sit. He was dressed for the workshop, knee-sprung corduroys and an old peat brown sweater, ragged and eaten with moth holes, and his receding hairline and new short-cropped hair gave him the ponderous, bald-templed look of the marble senator on the cover of Hadley's Latin book.
How's the form? Fine, thanks.
Voice graveled and croaking. Down came the brows again, and he looked at me hard.
Good heavens, he said. You sound like a raven this morning.
What did that mean? Ablaze with shame, I slid into the chair he scraped out for me and, too embarrassed to meet his eye,
stared at his book. Cracked leather. Life and Letters of Lord Somebody, an old volume that had probably come from one of his estate sales, old Mrs. So-and-so up in Poughkeepsie, broken hip, no children, all very sad. He was pouring me tea, pushing a plate my way. In an attempt to hide my discomfort, I put my head down and plowed into the toast, and nearly choked, since my throat was too raw to swallow. Too quickly I reached for the tea, so I sloshed it on the tablecloth and had to scramble to blot it up.
No, no, it doesn't matter. Here.
My napkin was sopping wet. I didn't know what to do with it. In my confusion, I dropped it on top of my toast and reached under my glasses to rub my eyes.
I'm sorry,
I blurted.
Sorry?
He was looking at me as if I'd asked him for directions to a place he wasn't sure how to get to.
Oh, come now. Please don't make me go.
What's that?
Make you go? Go where?
He pulled his half-moon glasses low and looked at me over the tops of them.
Don't be ridiculous,
he said in a playful, half-irritated voice.
Tell you where I ought to make you go is straight back to bed. You sound like you're down with the Black Death.
But his manner failed to reassure me. Paralyzed with embarrassment, determined not to start crying, I found myself staring hard at the forlorn spot by the stove where, once upon a time, Cosmo's basket had stood.
Ah,
said Hobie, when he saw me looking at the empty corner.
Yes, there you go, deaf as a haddock, having 3 and 4 seizures a week, but still we wanted him to live forever. I blubbed like a baby. If you'd told me Welty was going to go before Cosmo, he spent half his life carrying that dog back and forth to the vet.
Look here, he said in an altered voice, leaning forward and trying to catch my eye when still I sat speechless and miserable.
Come on. I know you've been through a lot, but there's no need in the world to fuss about it now. You look very shook. Now, now, yes you do, he said crisply. Very shook indeed, and bless you, flinching a bit. Bad dose of something, for sure. Don't fret. Everything's all right. Go back to bed, why don't you? And we'll hash it out later. I know, but...
I turned my head away to stifle a wet, burbling sneeze.
I don't have any place to go.
He leaned back in his chair, courteous, careful, something a little dusty about him.
Theo,
tapping at his lower lip.
How old are you? 15. 15 and a half. And?
He seemed to be working out how to ask it.
What about your grandfather?
Oh, I said helplessly, after a pause.
You've spoken to him? He knows that you've nowhere to go? Well, shit.
It just slipped out. Hobie put up a hand to reassure me.
You don't understand. I mean, I don't know if he has Alzheimer's or what, but when they called him, he didn't even ask to speak to me.
So... Hobie leaned his chin heavily in his hand and eyed me like a skeptical schoolteacher.
You didn't speak to him?
No. I mean, not personally. This lady was there, helping out.
Xandra's friend, Lisa. Solicitous, following me around, voicing gentle but increasingly urgent concerns that the family be notified, had retreated to a corner at some point to dial the number I gave her, and got off the phone with such a look that it had elicited from Xandra the only laugh of the evening.
This lady?
Said Hobie, in the silence that had fallen, in a voice you might employ with a mental patient.
Right. I mean...
I scrubbed a hand over my face. The colors in the kitchen were too intense. I felt lightheaded, out of control.
I guess Dorothy answered the phone, and Lisa said she was like, okay, wait, not even oh no, or what happened, or how terrible, just hang on, let me get him. And then my granddad came on, and Lisa told him about the wreck, and he listened, and then he said, well, he was sorry to hear it, but in this sort of tone, Lisa said. Not what I can do or when is the funeral or anything, just like, thank you for calling, we appreciate it, bye. I mean, I could have told her.
I added nervously when Hobie didn't answer. Because, I mean, they really didn't like my dad. Really didn't like him. Dorothy is his stepmother, and they hated each other from day one. But he never got along with Grandpa Decker, either. All right, steady on. And I mean, my dad was in some trouble when he was a kid. That might have had something to do with it. He was arrested, but I don't know what for. Honestly, I don't know why. But they never wanted anything to do with him for as long as I remember. And they never wanted anything to do with me, either. Calm down. I'm not trying to. Because I swear, I hardly ever met them. I really don't know them at all. But there's no reason for them to hate me. Not that my grandpa's such a great guy. He was pretty abusive to my dad, actually. Shh, no carrying on. I'm not trying to put the screws on you. I just want to know. No, now listen, he said as I tried to talk over him, batting away my words as if he was trying to shoo a fly from the table. My mother's lawyer is here, in the city. Will you come with me to see him? No, I said in confusion as his eyebrows came together. Not a lawyer, but that handles money. I talked to him on the phone before I left.
Okay, said Pippa, laughing, pink-cheeked from the cold. What's wrong with this dog? Has he never seen a car?
Bright red hair, green wool hat. The shock of seeing her in broad daylight was a dash of cold water. She had a hitch in her walk, probably from the accident, but there was a grasshopper lightness to it, like the odd, graceful preliminary to a dance step, and she was wrapped in so many layers against the cold that she looked like a colorful little cocoon with feet.
He was yowling like a cat, she said,
unwinding one of her many patterned scarves as Popchick danced at her feet with the end of his leash in his mouth.
Does he always make that weird noise? I mean, a cab would go by and, woo, in the air, I was flying him like a kite. People were laughing their heads off.
Yes, stooping to speak to the dog, rubbing the top of his head with her knuckles.
You need a bath, don't you? Is he a Maltese?
She said, glancing up. Furiously, I nodded, back of my hand to my mouth, trying to choke back a sneeze.
I love dogs.
I could hardly hear what she was saying, so dazzled was I by her eyes on mine.
I have a dog book, and I memorized every breed there is. If I had a big dog, I'd have a Newfoundland, like Nana in Peter Pan. And if I had a small dog, well, I change my mind all the time. I like all the little terriers, Jack Russells especially. They're always so funny and friendly on the street. But I know a wonderful Basenji, too. And I met a really great Pekingese the other day. Really, really tiny and really intelligent. Only royalty could have them in China. They're a very ancient breed.
Maltese are ancient, too, I croaked, glad to have an interesting fact to contribute. They date back to ancient Greece.
That's why you picked a Maltese? Because it was ancient?
Stifling a cough. She was saying something else, to the dog, not me, but I'd fallen into another fit of sneezing. Quickly, Hobie scrabbled for the closest thing at hand, a table napkin, and passed it over to me.
All right, enough, he said. Back to bed.
No, no, he said as I tried to hand the napkin back to him.
You keep it. Now tell me, he said, eyeing my wrecked plate, spilled tea, and soggy toast. What can I bring you for breakfast?
Caught between sneezes, I gave a bright, Russian-accented shrug I'd picked up from Boris.
Anything. All right, then, if you don't mind it, I'll make you some oatmeal. Easy on the throat. Don't you have any socks?
She was busy with the dog, mustard-yellow sweater and hair like an autumn leaf, and her colors were mixed up and confused with the bright colors of the kitchen. Striped apples glowing in a yellow bowl, the sharp ding of silver glinting from the coffee can where Hobie kept his paintbrushes.
Pajamas?
Hobie was saying.
No. I'll see what I can find of Welty's, and when you get out of those things, I'll throw them in the wash. Now, off with you, he said, clapping his hand on my shoulder so suddenly I jumped. You can stay. As long as however you like. And don't worry, I'll go with you to see your solicitor.
It'll be all fine.
2. Groggy, shivering, I made my way down the dark hall and eased between the covers, which were heavy and ice cold. The room smelled damp, and though there were many interesting things to look at, a pair of terracotta griffins, Victorian beadwork pictures, even a crystal ball, the dark brown walls, their deep, dry texture like cocoa powder, soaked me through and through with a sense of Hobie's voice and also of Welty's, a friendly brown that saturated me to the core and spoke in warm, old-fashioned tones, so that drifting in a lurid stream of fever, I felt rapt and reassured by their presence, whereas Pippa had cast a shifting, colored nimbus of her own. I was thinking in a mixed-up way about scarlet leaves and bonfire sparks flying up in darkness, and also my painting, how it would look against such a rich, dark, light-absorbing ground. Yellow feathers, flash of crimson, bright black eyes. I woke with a jolt, terrified, flailing, back on the bus again with someone lifting the painting from my knapsack, to find Pippa lifting up the sleepy dog, her hair brighter than everything else in the room.
"Sorry, but he needs to go out," she said. "Don't sneeze on me."
I scrambled up on my elbows.
"Sorry. Hi,"
I said idiotically, smearing an arm across my face, and then,
"I'm feeling better."
Her unsettling golden brown eyes went around the room.
"Are you bored? Do you want me to bring you some colored pencils?" "Colored pencils?"
I was baffled.
"Why?"
To draw with?"
"Well, not a big deal," she said. "All you had to say was no."
Out she whisked, Popchick trotting after her, leaving behind her a smell of cinnamon gum, and I turned my face into the pillow, feeling crushed by my stupidity. Though I would have died rather than told anyone, I was worried that my exuberant drug use had damaged my brain and my nervous system, and maybe even my soul in some irreparable and perhaps not readily apparent way. While I was lying there worrying, my cell phone beeped. "Guess where I am? Pool at MGM Grand."
I blinked.
"Boris?" I texted in reply.
"Yes, is me." "What was he doing there? Are you okay?"
I texted back.
"Yes, but very sleepy. We been doing those eight balls, OMG.
And then another ding.
"Great fun.
Party, party. You? Living under underpass?" "NYC," I texted back. "Sick in bed. Why are you at MGM Grand?" "Here with Katie and Amber and those guys." Then, coming in a second later, "Do you know of drink called White Russian? Very nice tasting, not very good name for drink, though." A knock.
"Are you all right?"
said Hobie, sticking his head in the door.
"Can I bring you anything?"
I put the phone aside.
"No, thank you." "Well, tell me when you're hungry, please. There's loads of food. The fridge is so stuffed I can hardly get the door closed. We had people in for Thanksgiving." "What is that racket?"
he said, looking around. "Just my phone." Boris had texted. "You can't believe the last few days."
"Well, I'll leave you to it. Let me know if you need something."
Once he was gone, I rolled to face the wall and texted back,
"MGM Grand? With K.T. Behrman?"
The answer came almost immediately.
"Yes. Also Amber and Mimi and Jessica and K.T.'s sister Jordan, who is in college." "WTF? You left at a bad time."
Then, almost immediately, before I could reply, "Got to go. Amber needs her phone. Call me later," I texted back, but there was no reply. And it would be a long, long time before I heard anything from Boris again. 3. That day, and the next day or two, flopping around in a bewilderingly soft pair of Welty's old pajamas, were so topsy-turvy and deranged with fever that repeatedly I found myself back at Port Authority, running away from people, dodging through crowds and ducking into tunnels with oily water dripping on me, or else in Las Vegas again on the CAT bus, riding through wind-whipped industrial plazas with blown sand hitting the windows and no money to pay my fare. Time slid from under me in drifts like ice skids on the highway, punctuated by sudden, sharp flashes where my wheels caught and I was flung into ordinary time. Hobie bringing me aspirins and ginger ale with ice. Popchick, freshly bathed, fluffy and snow white, hopping up on the foot of the bed to march back and forth across my feet.
"Here,"
said Pippa, coming over to the bed and poking me in the side so she could sit down.
"Move over."
I sat up, fumbling for my glasses. I'd been dreaming about the painting. I'd had it out, looking at it. Or had I? And found myself looking around anxiously to make sure I'd put it away before I went to sleep.
"What's the matter?"
I forced myself to turn my gaze to her face. "Nothing." I'd crawled under the bed several times just to put my hands on the pillowcase, and I couldn't help wondering if I'd been careless and left it poking from under the bed. "Don't look down there," I told myself. "Look at her."
"Here,"
Pippa was saying.
"Made you something. Hold out your hand."
"Wow," I said, staring at the spiked, Kelly green origami in my palm.
"Thanks. Do you know what it is?"
Deer? Crow? Gazelle? Panicked, I glanced up at her.
"Give up? A frog. Can't you tell? Here, put it on the nightstand. It's supposed to hop when you press on it like this, see?"
As I fooled around with it, awkwardly, I was aware of her eyes on me, eyes that had a light and wildness to them, a careless power like the eyes of a kitten.
"Can I look at this?"
She'd snatched up my iPod and was busily scrolling through it.
"Hmm,"
she said.
"Nice. Magnetic fields? Mazzy Star? Nico? Nirvana? Oscar Peterson? No classical?"
"Well, there's some," I said, feeling embarrassed. Everything she'd mentioned except the Nirvana had actually been my mom's, and even some of that was hers.
"I'd make you some CDs, except I left my computer at school. I guess I could mail you some. I've been listening to a lot of Ervo Pärt lately. Don't ask me why. I have to listen on my headphones because it drives my roommates nuts."
Terrified she was going to catch me staring, unable to wrench my eyes away, I watched her studying my iPod with bent head, ears rosy pink, raised line of scar tissue slightly puckered underneath the scalding red hair. In profile, her downcast eyes were long, heavy-lidded, with a tenderness that reminded me of the angels and page boys in the Northern European Masterworks book I'd checked and rechecked from the library.
"Hey,"
words drying up in my mouth.
"Yes?"
Why wasn't it like before? Why couldn't I think of anything to say?
"Ooh,"
she'd glanced up at me, and then was laughing again, laughing too hard to talk.
"What is it? Why are you looking at me like that?"
"Like what?" I said, alarmed.
"Like..."
I wasn't sure how to interpret the pop-eyed face she made at me.
"Choking person?
Mongoloid? Fish?"
"Don't be mad. You're just so serious. It's just..."
She glanced down at the iPod and broke out laughing again.
"Ooh,"
she said.
"Shostakovich. Intense."
How much did she remember, I wondered, afire with humiliation yet unable to tear my eyes from her? It wasn't the kind of thing you could ask, but still I wanted to know. Did she have nightmares too? Crowd fears? Sweats and panics? Did she ever have the sense of observing herself from afar, as I often did? As if the explosion had knocked my body and my soul into two separate entities that remained about 6 feet apart from one another? Her gust of laughter had a self-propelling recklessness I knew all too well from wild nights with Boris, an edge of giddiness and hysteria that I associated, in myself anyway, with having narrowly missed death. There had been nights in the desert where I was so sick with laughter, convulsed and doubled over with aching stomach for hours on end, I would happily have thrown myself in front of a car to make it stop. 4. On Monday morning, though I was far from well, I roused myself from my fog of aches and dozes and trudged dutifully into the kitchen and telephoned Mr. Bracegirdle's office. But when I asked for him, his secretary, after putting me on hold and then returning a bit too swiftly, informed me that Mr. Bracegirdle was out of the office, and no, she didn't have a number where he could be reached, and no, she was afraid she couldn't say when he might be in. Was there anything else? Well, I left Hobie's number with her, and was regretting that I'd been too slow on the draw to go ahead and schedule the appointment, when the phone rang.
212, eh?
Said the rich, clever voice. I left, I said stupidly. The cold in my head made me sound nasal and block-witted.
I'm in the city.
Yes, I gathered.
His tone was friendly but cool.
What can I do for you?
When I told him about my father, there was a deep breath.
Well, he said carefully, I'm sorry to hear it. When did this happen?
Last week. He listened without interrupting. In the 5 minutes or so it took me to fill him in, I heard him turn away at least two other calls.
Crikey,
he said when I'd finished talking.
That's quite a story, Theodore.
Crikey. In a different mood, I might have smiled. This was definitely a person my mother had known and liked.
It must have been dreadful for you out there,
he was saying.
Of course, I'm terribly sorry for your loss. It's all very sad. Though quite frankly, and I feel more comfortable saying this to you now, when he turned up, no one knew what to do. Your mother had of course confided some things. Even Samantha had expressed concerns. Well, as you know, it was a difficult situation. But I don't think anyone expected this. Thugs with baseball bats.
Well, thugs with baseball bats. I hadn't really meant for him to seize on that detail.
He was just standing there holding it. It's not like he hit me or anything.
Well, he laughed, an easy laugh that broke the tension.
$65,000 did seem like a very specific sum. I have to say, too, I went a bit beyond my authority as your counsel when we spoke on the phone, though under the circumstances I hope you'll forgive me. It was just that I smelled a bit of a rat.
Sorry, I said after a sick pause.
Over the phone, the money, you can withdraw it, from the 529 anyway. Large tax penalty, but it's possible.
Possible? I could have taken it?
An alternate future was flashing through my mind. Mr. Silver paid. Dad in his bathrobe checking the sports scores on his BlackBerry. Me in Spirsitskaya's class with Boris lazing across the aisle from me.
Although I do need to tell you that the money in the fund is actually a bit short of that,
Mr. Bracegirdle was saying.
Socked away and growing all the time, though. Not that we can't arrange for you to use some of it now, given your circumstances, but your mother was absolutely determined not to dip in it even with her financial troubles. The last thing she would have wanted was for your dad to get his hands on it. And yes, just between the two of us, I do think you were very smart to come back to the city on your own recognizance.
Sorry,
muffled conversation.
I've got an 11 o'clock. I've got to run. You're staying at Samantha's now, I gather?
The question threw me for a loop.
No,
I said.
With some friends in the village.
Well, splendid. Just so long as you're comfortable. At any rate, I'm afraid I have to dash now. What do you say we continue this discussion in my office? I'll put you back through to Patsy so she can schedule an appointment.
Great,
I said.
Thank you.
But when I got off the phone, I felt sick. Like someone had just reached their hand in my chest and wrenched loose a lot of ugly wet stuff around my heart.
Everything okay?
Said Hobie, crossing through the kitchen stopping suddenly to see the look on my face.
Sure.
But it was a long walk down the hall to my room, and once I closed the door and climbed back in bed, I began to cry, or half-cry, ugly, dry wheezes with my face pressed in the pillow, while Popchick pawed at my shirt and snuffled anxiously against the back of my neck. 5. Before this, I'd been feeling better, but somehow it was like this news made me ill all over again. As the day wore on and my fever climbed to its former dizzying wobble, I could think of nothing but my dad. I have to call him, I thought, starting again and again from bed, just as I was drifting off. It was as if his death wasn't real, but only a rehearsal, a trial run. The real death, the permanent one, was yet to happen, and there was time to stop it if only I found him, if only he was answering his cell phone, if Zandra could reach him from work. I have to get hold of him. I have to let him know. Then, later, the day was over, it was dark. I had fallen into a troubled half-dream, where my dad was excoriating me for screwing up some air travel reservations, when I became aware of lights in the hallway, a tiny backlit shadow. Pippa, coming suddenly into the room with stumbling step, almost like someone had pushed her, looking doubtfully behind her, saying,
"Should I wake him?"
"Wait," I said, half to her and half to my dad, who was falling back rapidly into the darkness, some violent stadium crowd on the other side of a tall, arched gate. When I got my glasses on, I saw she had her coat on like she was going out.
"Sorry?"
I said, arm over my eyes, confused in the glare from the lamp.
"No, I'm sorry, it's just, I mean,"
pushing a strand of hair out of her face,
"I'm leaving, and I wanted to say goodbye."
"Goodbye?"
"Oh."
Her pale brows drew together. She looked back in the doorway to Hobie, who had vanished, and back to me.
"Right, well,"
her voice seemed slightly panicked,
"I'm going back, tonight. Anyway, it was nice to see you. I hope everything works out for you, okay?"
"Tonight?"
"Yeah, I'm flying out now. She has me in boarding school,"
she said when I continued to goggle at her.
"I'm here for Thanksgiving. Here to see the doctor, remember?"
"Oh, right." I was staring at her very hard and hoping that I was still asleep. Boarding school rang a vague bell, but I thought it was something I'd dreamed.
"Yeah."
She seemed uneasy, too.
"Too bad you didn't get here earlier. It was fun. Hobie cooked. We had tons of people over. Anyway, I was lucky I got to come at all. I had to get permission from Dr. Commenzind. We don't have Thanksgiving off at my school."
"What do they do?"
"They don't celebrate it. Well, I think they make turkey or something for the people who do."
"What school is this?" When she told me the name, with a half-humorous quirk of her mouth, I was shocked. Institut Mont Heffeli was a school in Switzerland, barely accredited according to Andy, where only the very dumbest and most disturbed girls went.
"Mont Heffeli? Really? I thought it was very..."
The word psychiatric was wrong.
"Wow. Well, Aunt Margaret says I'll get used to it."
She was fooling around with the origami frog on the nightstand, trying to make it jump, only it was bent and tipping to one side.
"And the view is like the mountain on the Caron d'Ache box. Snow caps and flower meadow and all that. Otherwise, it's like one of those dull Euro horror movies where nothing much happens."
I felt like I was missing something, or maybe still asleep. The only person I'd ever known who went to Mont Heffeli was James Villiers' sister, Dorrit Villiers, and the story was she'd been sent there because she stabbed her boyfriend in the hand with a knife.
"Yeah, it's a weird place,"
she said, bored eyes flickering around the room.
"A school for loonies. Not many places I could get in with my head injury, though. They have a clinic attached,"
she said, shrugging.
"Doctors on staff. Bigger deal than you'd think. I mean, I have problems since I got hit on the head, but it's not like I'm nuts or a shoplifter."
"Yeah, but..." I was still trying to get
horror movie out of my mind.
Switzerland? That's pretty cool.
If you say so.
I knew this girl, Lally Fuchs, who went to La Rosie. She said they had a chocolate break every morning.
Well, we don't even get jam on our toast.
Her hand was speckled and pale against the black of her coat.
Only the eating disorder girls get it. If you want sugar in your tea, you have to steal the packets from the nurse's station.
Worse and worse. Do you know a girl named Dorrit Villiers?
No. She was there, but then they sent her someplace else. I think she tried to scratch somebody in the face. They had her in lockup for a while.
What?
That's not what they call it,
she said, rubbing her nose.
It's a farm-looking building they call La Grange. You know, all milkmaid and fake rustic. Nicer than the residence houses, but the doors are alarmed and they have guards and stuff.
Well, I mean,
I thought of Dorrit Villiers. Frizzy gold hair, blank blue eyes like a loopy Christmas tree angel, and didn't know what to say.
That's only where they put the really crazy girls, La Grange. I'm in Bessonnet with a bunch of French-speaking girls. It's supposed to be so I learn French better, but all it means is nobody talks to me.
You should tell her you don't like it, your aunt.
She grimaced.
I do, but then she starts telling me how much it costs, or else says I'm hurting her feelings. Anyway,
she said uneasily in an I've-got-to-go voice, looking over her shoulder.
Huh,
I said at last after a woozy pause. Day and night, my delirium had been colored with an awareness of her in the house, recurring energy surges of happiness at the sound of her voice in the hallway, her footsteps. We were going to make a blanket tent. She would be waiting for me at the ice rink, bright hum of excitement at all the things we were going to do when I got better. In fact, it seemed we had been doing things, such as stringing necklaces of rainbow-colored candy while the radio played Belle and Sebastian, and then later on, wandering through a non-existent casino arcade in Washington Square. Hobie, I noticed, was standing discreetly in the hall.
Sorry, he said, glancing at his wristwatch. I really hate to rush you.
Sure,
she said. To me, she said,
goodbye then. Hope you feel better.
Wait.
What?
She said, half turning.
You'll be back for Christmas, right?
No, Aunt Margaret's.
When are you coming back, then?
Well,
one-shouldered shrug.
Dunno. Spring holidays, maybe.
Pips, said Hobie,
though he was really speaking to me instead of her.
Right,
she said, brushing her hair from her eyes. I waited until I heard the front door shut. Then I got out of bed and pulled aside the curtain. Through the dusty glass, I watched them going together down the front steps, Pippa in her pink scarf and hat, hurrying slightly alongside Hobie's large, well-dressed form. For a while after they turned the corner, I stood at the window looking out at the empty street. Then, feeling lightheaded and forlorn, I trudged to her bedroom and, unable to resist, cracked the door a sliver. It was the same as 2 years before, except emptier, Wizard of Oz and Save Tibet posters. No wheelchair, window piled with white pebbles of sleet on the sill, but it smelled like her. It was still warm and alive with her presence, and as I stood breathing in her atmosphere, I felt a huge, happy smile on my face just to be standing there with her fairy tale books, her perfume bottles, her sparkly tray of barrettes, and her Valentine collection. Paper lace, cupids, and columbines. Edwardian suitors with rose bouquets pressed to their hearts. Quietly, tiptoeing even though I was barefoot, I walked over to the silver-framed photographs on the dresser. Welty and Cosmo. Welty and Pippa. Pippa and her mother. Same hair, same eyes. With a younger and thinner Hobie. Low buzzing noise inside the room. Guiltily, I turned. Someone coming? No, only Popchick, cotton white after his bath, nestled amongst the pillows of her unmade bed, and snoring with a drooling, blissful, half-purring sound. And though there was something pathetic about it, taking comfort in her left-behind things like a puppy snuggled in an old coat. I crawled in under the sheets and nestled down beside him, smiling foolishly at the smell of her comforter and the silky feel of it on my cheek. 6.
"Well, well," said Mr. Bracegirdle, as he shook Hobie's hand and then mine. "Theodore, I do have to say, you're growing up to look a great deal like your mother. I wish she could see you now."
I tried to meet his eye and not seem embarrassed. The truth was, though I had my mother's straight hair and something of her light and dark coloring, I looked a whole lot more like my father. A likeness so strong that no chatty bystander, no waitress in any coffee shop had allowed it to pass unremarked. Not that I'd ever been happy about it, resembling the parent I couldn't stand. But to see a younger version of his sulky, drunk-driving face in the mirror was particularly upsetting now that he was dead. Hobie and Mr. Bracegirdle were chatting in a subdued way. Mr. Bracegirdle was telling Hobie how he'd met my mother, dawning remembrance from Hobie.
"Yes, I remember. A foot in less than an hour. My God, I came out of my auction and nothing was moving. I was uptown at the old Park Burnett. On Madison, across from the Carlisle?" "Yes, quite a long hoof home." "You deal antiques? Down in the village, Theo says."
Politely, I sat and listened to their conversation. Friends in common, gallery owners and art collectors, the Rakers and the Rainbergs, the Fawcetts and the Vogels and the Mildebergers and Depews, on to vanished New York landmarks, the closing of Lutèce, Le Caravelle, Café des Artistes. What would your mother have thought, Theodore? She loved Café des Artistes. How did he know that, I wondered. While I didn't for an instant believe some of the things my dad, in moments of meanness, had insinuated about my mother, it did appear that Mr. Bracegirdle had known my mother a good deal better than I would have thought. Even the non-legal books on his shelf seemed to suggest a correspondence, an echo of interests between them. Art books, Agnes Martin, Edwin Dickinson, poetry too, first editions, Ted Berrigan, Frank O'Hara, Meditations in an Emergency. I remembered the day she'd turned up flushed and happy with the exact same edition of Frank O'Hara, which I assume she'd found at the Strand, since we didn't have the money for something like that. But when I thought about it, I realized she hadn't told me where she'd got it.
"Well, Theodore," said Mr. Bracegirdle, calling me back to myself.
Though elderly, he had the calm, well-tanned look of someone who spent a lot of his spare time on the tennis court. The dark pouches under his eyes gave him a genial panda bear look.
"You're old enough that a judge would consider your wishes above all in this matter," he was saying, "especially since your guardianship would be uncontested." "Of course," he said to Hobie, "we could seek a temporary guardianship for the upcoming interlude, but I don't think that will be necessary. Clearly this arrangement is in the minor's best interests, as long as it's all right with you."
"That and more," said Hobie. "I'm happy if he's happy."
"You're fully prepared to act in an informal capacity as Theodore's adult custodian for the time being?"
"Informal, black tie, whatever's called for."
"There's your schooling to look after as well. We'd spoken of boarding school, as I recall, but that seems a lot to think of now, doesn't it?"
he said, noting the stricken look on my face.
"Shipping out as you've just arrived, and with the holidays coming up? No need to make any decisions at all at the moment, I shouldn't think,"
he said, with a glance at Hobie.
"I should think it would be fine if you just sat out the rest of this term, and we can sort it out later. And you know that you can, of course, call upon me at any time, day or night."
He was writing a phone number on a business card.
"This is my home number, and this is my cell." "My, my, that's a nasty cough you have there," he said, glancing up. "Quite a cough. Are you having that looked after, yes? And this is my number out in Bridgehampton.
I hope you won't hesitate to call me for any reason, if you need anything.
Trying hard, doing my best, to swallow another cough.
Thank you,